I'm very excited to introduce our next speaker, Josh Stamper, who I had actually not met in person before today, but I've spent quite a bit of time talking with him on the phone, and so I'm very excited that he is here today. And I'm trying to remember exactly, I don't have it in front of me, his specific job title, but it is something to do with irrigation specialist. And I find that to do no justice at all to the breadth of what he's tackling, and just if our conversations on the phone are any indication of his presentation today, I can say we're all in for a treat. And if it doesn't cover all of that, what I want to say is at the next break, which is going to be coming up after this, catch him, catch Dr. Strack, and have a chance to talk with them directly during the break. So welcome.
Thank you very much. So what we're going to talk a little bit about today is a agricultural water accounting for beer and pickles. And beer is one of my loves. Are there any brewers in the room? Does anybody homebrew? 2, 3, 4. All right. A couple guys that brew. I've got some treats for you afterwards. But the one of the things that a lot of times gets bandied around a lot is how do we use water and water footprints. And this really kind of came around in an era of time after we started talking about carbon footprints. And we had all these carbon calculators. And we had all these metrics to use for, you know, how do we use carbon. But then also, as water became in vogue over the last decade to talk about, there's a lot of interest in that. For those of you guys that like beer, I want you to just jot something down on a corner of a piece of paper. How many gallons of water do you think goes into pint of beer? Whoever gets closest wins the pint of beer. Okay. So my role as the irrigation specialist for the University of Minnesota is providing assistance to farmers and irrigators on the use of irrigation water, specifically for the prevention of degradation of groundwater. My background is not as an engineer, it's as an agronomist. And in the world of irrigation, most of my peers are engineers, which has been really interesting from my standpoint in the fact that I was not a academic star as a mathematician when I was younger. But at the same time, you do not understand something until you can explain it mathematically. And I'm sure that anyone who's ever taken Otto's class, that probably gets beaten into you. And sometimes it's hard to get farmers to wrap their brain around that, is that our ability to accurately supply irrigation water and meet crop water demands is a function of mathematics. And so as we move through this, we're really looking closely at how do we quantify water and how do we measure water use. This is, I'd say, 90% of my presentations, I include this slide. And I usually, ask people to think of a few of your favorite things. Raindrops on roses, whiskers on kittens. Water really is, there's a saying sometimes in agriculture that if you can't grow it, you have to mine it. And in many ways, that's true. But also at the same time, water is really, and the use of water is really something that we can't get away from. Everything we do, from coffee in the morning to beer in the evening, we use water. We use water in many industrial practices. So it's something that water use is something that we're not going to get away from, and it's only going to intensify as we move forward and as populations increase. So today we're going to talk about a couple topics. And it's always kind of dangerous for me. I came from a long line of Southern Baptist ministers, and so when someone gives me a microphone, that means that I can move around the room, and if you aren't careful, I'll come back and start healing people. When it comes to plants, I always start topics about sex. Plants' primary role in life is they want to reproduce, okay? And to do that, they're going to intercept sunlight, they're going to take up water, and they're going to assimilate carbon. And they're going to do those three things, and that's a primary function of plant growth and development, to reproduce. As to do this, plants are going to mine water out of the soil profile. The next component is, how much water does it take to produce malting barley? How much water does it take to produce cucumbers that go into the barnache that we all hold dear? And then, how does the seasonal availability of water impact some of these other things? I'm sure most all of you, as hydrologists or groundwater professionals, have seen this. And it's pretty universal, and everybody acknowledges, you know, the role that the water cycle plays in how we use groundwater and surface water. One of the things that I always found really interesting is there's a really great quote: "All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they shall return." Where'd that come from? Ecclesiastes 1:7. We've had a pretty good understanding of the basis of the hydrologic cycle for a long time. Okay? In agriculture, one of the things that we've realized as we've gone forward over the years is the role that evapotranspiration plays in where we site agriculture and how we use water. The expansion and how we've been able to successfully or unsuccessfully use water in western states has also been a function of our ability to measure evapotranspiration. Yeah. So evapotranspiration is the cumulative sum of evaporation of water from the soil surface and transpiration of water by plants. And this is a slide I use for farmers. And this is a much more simplistic math than what Otto's going to use, but for farmers, they can find this intimidating. Actual ET, measuring the total evaporation of water coming off a crop, is really expensive and hard to measure. One of my peers explained it to me. They said that the science of measuring evapotranspiration is one of the most desperate branches of one of the most desperate sciences. Which is true. But to combat this, we use meteorological measurements to calculate potential evapotranspiration from reference crops, specifically alfalfa. So we'll use Otto's alfalfa field as a reference. And that reference crop ET will multiply by a crop coefficient to determine the amount of water that our actual crop is going to be using. And we'll do this, you know, day by day, and that's how we keep up water balances that we'll talk about here in just a minute. So in ag, we typically use soils as a medium to store water. And we think about the water that we store as available water holding capacity. And this is really determined a lot by texture. As we move through from coarser textured soils to finer textured soils, the range of our available water changes. The coarser the soil texture, the less water we can store within that. The finer the texture, we can hold volumetrically more, but sometimes it's not always plant available. At the lower side of this gets into permanent wilting point. When we exceed this water holding capacity, we end up with gravimetric water or drainage or runoff, depending on slopes. So with that knowledge, we'll transition into some of our scenarios. In 2014, and I'm just to kind of, all agronomy is site specific. So when I talk about this scenario, it's not going to be the same for someone who's in Benton County on a Zimmerman soil, or, you know, Otto's farm down in, you know, Wisconsin. So I'll preface this by saying I use the 2014 weather data from out in kind of Pope, Western Stearns County, and I use that area because typically that's where we grow some small grains. That was also one of the sites for where we have our small grain variety trials, and I pulled all of our yield data and scenarios from that. The assumptions are that our cucurbit and barley crops are going to be produced during the same time period, which makes it easy for me because I can pull the same climate data in. We're using an Esterville sandy loam, which is typically a common soil in that area. It's also a common soil that we irrigate for some reasons that I'll talk about. All of our crop water requirements are coming from a paper that Dean Steele put together where they used developed irrigation scheduling software from Minnesota and North Dakota, and then also used the FAO 56 document to determine the cucurbit water use. So we ran this scenario on an Esterville sandy loam. For those of you who don't have a hard time getting a date on a Saturday night, that essentially means that you have 15 inches of loam or sandy loam over top of coarse sand and gravel. Within that soil profile, we have about 3.8 inches of available water holding capacity. And here I've in these three images, you can see the transition as we go from these really beautiful silt loam, sandy loam soils as they transition a little bit deeper, and we start seeing the presence of coarse sand, and then as you get down towards the bottom of that profile, it turns to coarse sand and gravel. Position on the landscape a lot of times determines when those cobbles or that gravel may come to the surface. But this is just to give you a general idea of, you know, the types of soils that, you know, we're going to be looking at and thinking about. When I started this, one of my primary interests was, okay, let's look at the water use of barley. And this is actually, when we work with farmers, we tend to think about how much of the soil water are we using. When we go back and think about that profile, we know that we've got 3.8 inches. This is, you know, if we use all that water, we're down here at 100% depletion. If we have a full profile of water, we've got 3.8 inches. You know, right here, any more inputs, which you'll see down here is irrigation or rainfall, any of our inputs beyond that 3.8 inches is going to cause runoff or recharge or deep percolation. Or in the world of when you fertilize these crops, sometimes we think about it from a leaching perspective where we're losing nitrate, nitrogen to surficial aquifers, which is a major concern in many parts of our state. So I ran the scenario the first year this year in a dryland condition. And, you know, anytime you see our water curve drop below our red line, that red line is our management allowed depletion, a lot of farmers kind of stop and go, wait a minute. You know, at that point, I'm water stressing a crop. Okay? There's going to be a yield loss associated with that water stress, especially in this time period. What's happening right there? Sex. Plants are reproducing, and they're putting a lot of their energy and their photosynthetic resources into reproduction. You talk to anybody who works in agriculture, you don't mess with things when they're reproducing. So we turned around, and I ran the scenario with supplementing irrigation water. 2014 was a pretty mild year as far as climate in this area. We had plenty of for guys who had medium to heavier textured soils, they had plenty of precipitation. And compared to 2012, when we had, you know, pretty extensive drought late in the season, we would have used a lot more water. But in this year, 2.68 inches of water carried us through pretty consistently. So when we compare our water use from our dry land versus our irrigated crops, we use a pretty simplistic approach for when we're short on meeting ET for every inch of water. Typically, it's between 4 and 5 bushels of yield that are sacrificed in small grains. So if we look at a dryland scenario, an acre of barley would have needed a little under 300,000 gallons per acre, which equates to 3,328 gallons per bushel of barley. If we irrigated the scenario, we have higher yields, we use more water, but we have a little bit better water use efficiency. So I'm showing you this to, you know, kind of underscore the point that we don't really irrigate needlessly in agriculture. There is a yield bump that is associated in situations where you're running into water stress. There is some societal gain from using groundwater. I think in many ways I'll argue that Minnesota is probably one of the few places in the country where we can use water sustainably just because of the volumes of recharge that we observe from spring melts and the relatively limited need for irrigation water. In Minnesota, we irrigate as a function of soil type, not climate. It's the opposite when you go to western states. I came from Kansas and Nebraska before I came here. There we irrigate as a function of climate, not necessarily soil type. So we start looking at that. That's kind of how that breaks down. For those of you who like to brew, I've got the complete recipe for Jake Scott's Lawyers, Guns, and Money. It's a hoppy saison. It's quite delightful. Jake is a brewer at a brewery in Portland. We went to college together, and we both, when we were both 18, we left the mountains of western North Carolina looking for something to eat. And since then, we have traveled all over the world. So this was the beer that I used to run my scenarios on for determining, you know, water use in beer, specifically in the barley that goes in the beer. These are some of the vital stats for this brew. We're going to assume an 80% brew house efficiency. And so to brew a 2-keg batch, we need about 73 pounds of barley malt. I make an assumption that there's a 1-to-1 ratio of barley to barley malt. That's not true, but it keeps our math really simple, and I don't want to get into the losses that are associated with the malting process. Just trying to focus on the agronomic side of this. So, barley water in our hoppy saison. So you can see we end up with about 5,000 gallons of water in our 31-gallon batch of beer. So based off of that, we keep running through here. There's 248 pints in that 31-gallon batch, and we end up with 20.2 gallons of barley water per pint of Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Who was closest? Who had 20 gallons? 27? You had 15? Anybody else get close?
I was way low.
You were way low. How many? What did you think it was, Eric?
I was thinking seven.
It's actually quite a bit. One of the things that I thought was particularly interesting was, who had it? Pass that down to her. So one of the things that this has been. If you look at some of the work that SAB Miller has done in conjunction with World Wildlife Fund, they've really spent a lot of time and effort trying to catalog the water footprint of beer. And one of the things that they found is that it's pretty widely accepted that the cultivation of the agricultural inputs in beer accounts for, you know, close to 90% of that water use. And so when we start looking at these, barley really does represent a really large component of the water footprint for beer. As you move around the country, those numbers change pretty drastically. You know, when you go into countries where they may use more sugar in the production of their beer, or they may use a ratio of corn, those footprints start to change, especially with the recipes that are used. So that's kind of how we lay that out. So when we jump into pickling cucumbers, and growing up in North Carolina, you're always, when you go down to the low country, you see a lot of cucurbit production. North Carolina, throughout the 90s, was number one in cucumber production, specifically because that is the home of Mount Olive. So what I did was I looked at the same climate scenario. I used the crop coefficient curves for cucumbers from the FAO 56 document and ran the same scenario. Cucumbers actually, despite the fact that they have a much shorter growing season than barley, they use more water. They're a succulent crop. We shouldn't expect anything different. And they also needed irrigation to keep them above our management allowed depletion threshold. So as we go through that, surprisingly though, they used the same amount of irrigation water as our barley did. But seasonal demand and seasonal availability of water as we store it in the profile is really what determines our need for the right amount of water at the right rate, applied at the right time. And what's really interesting is that the period of water demand by crops is usually this nice, you know, bell-shaped curve. You know, early in the growing season when there's not a lot of vegetative growth, there's usually not very much water demand, which typically was why we don't usually see lots of stress early in the season. It usually comes during this period of, an agronomically crude term would be the big suck, which is really when our maximum, you know, we have maximum canopy growth and development. We're transitioning into that from vegetative to reproductive growth stages, and those are periods where we're going to use a lot of water. You know, when right before Otto gets ready to cut hay, he's going to be, you know, at that period of max evapotranspiration, which I got a kick out of. You know, if I didn't know who Otto was and he called me and described what he was going to do, I'd say that he was batshit crazy. but knowing his capacity to use Darcy's law, I'm not really quite so worried about that. So, I get a lot of these calls sometimes, and sometimes it's, you know, talking people out of things, but I'll be interested to learn more about this. So our cucurbit calculations, for those of you who might like to play words with friends and you love poaching other people's words, cucurbit's a 14-point word in Scrabble, and it's also one of the great ways to use curb. So you can get more mileage out of low-hanging fruit. So we use 13.4 inches of water. That's 363,000 gallons. And our yields, we're going to operate under the assumption that over multiple harvests, we're going to collect just under 200,000 U.S. number two pickles. And this is actually yield data that came from North Carolina. I wasn't able to find commercial pickling cucumber yield data for the upper Midwest. So I just went ahead and used some of the North Carolina data, which brings us to about just under 2 gallons of water per number two pickle. And those would be the, you know, whole dills that you would see if you bought, you know, Gedney State Fair pickles. That's about typically about the amount of water that we're going to be using in the production of those cucurbits. So some of our considerations, when we look at crop water use, all agronomy is site-specific. Our climate and our cropping systems will drastically impact the amount of water that we use throughout the growing season. One of the things that I always think is really interesting is our reference crop, typically for irrigation scheduling. Our reference crop ET is actually alfalfa. If we had planted alfalfa in these fields and harvested them 3 times and made hay off of that, we would have used almost twice the amount of water. We would have used about 22 inches, where we would have had 22 inches of ET. We would have more thoroughly explored the soil profile. We would have done a better job of mining soil moisture, but we would have used more water. I don't get into value judgments about how we use water for different crops. I know that there's a market for it. Right now, if you were to haul a load of hay to go to market in South Texas, fetch almost $300 a ton. If you had it in small square bales, it would push $400 a ton. There are values for things that we produce and things that we produce with water. There are also ecological values of water. The role for us is finding the balance between how do we use water responsibly and be able to produce things that we all need and or want and be able to maintain some of our ecological services. Year to year, 2012, which was arguably one of the worst drought years in the upper Midwest in 25 years, our ET would have increased, our precipitation would have decreased, and our irrigation amounts would have tripled. So year-to-year impacts, or year-to-year climate change impacts how we use water to produce things. So in conclusion, all three of our scenarios used, or they observed the same amount of precipitation, but the seasonal availability of that soil moisture a lot of times is going to require supplemental irrigation. An artisan beer and a pickle are going to need a little bit over 22 gallons of water to be produced in this part of the world. These numbers could vary as much as 30% based off of the climate, location, and some of the agronomic practices. So with that, if you guys have questions, I would love to handle them.
Once again, we have microphones, so if you have questions,
go ahead, Eric.
How closely managed are you know, your average irrigator in, I don't know, Bonanza Valley or something? I mean, do they pay pretty close attention to, you know, the soil moisture and try and track things pretty well, or do they irrigate recreationally? Or I mean, how does that look, and what do you have on your plate as far as getting people to maybe pay more attention to what you've just discussed?
So as far as irrigation in Minnesota, historically, we probably have less than 20%, and I would say 20% would be an optimistic number, 20% of our irrigators use irrigation scheduling software. Because we tend to only irrigate coarse outwash soils, a lot of farmers will say, okay, you know, I need to irrigate every 2 to 3 days based off of how much water they put on their pivot. And so you have this really, it's not infinitely variable, but it's this incredibly variable calculation that farmers have in their brain. They know that peak water use is going to be, you know, a quarter of an inch of water a day for a set crop. It may be a little bit more than that, maybe a little bit less. But they'll typically, you know, view irrigation from that standpoint of they're just trying to match ET. The more advanced growers, the growers who tend to watch margins a little bit more closely, are now probably investing more in soil moisture monitoring techniques, whether they're using time domain reflectometry, capacitance sensors, or soil water potential type instrumentation. The advent of cheap, ubiquitous wireless communication has really, I think, will drive a lot of our advances in irrigation water monitoring. I still work really hard to try to develop irrigation scheduling tools and water balance accounting tools for irrigators. But you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. It's hard to get guys excited about jumping into a big spreadsheet. My dad's comment, or a farmer's comment that I ran into one time, is I showed him the irrigation scheduling spreadsheet and the calculations, and he looked at me and he said, "I get pissed off reading TV Guide. Do you think I'm really going to use this?" And that's something realistic. A lot of these guys cover a lot of acres. They're very busy. They have families, and they want to keep it simple, stupid. And so when I look at irrigation scheduling, I view it from how do we make it as easy and as simplistic as possible? You know, and I think that's really, if we're going to be successful in driving good irrigation water management, we really have to keep it simple, Stamper. Yes.
I have a question for you regarding water footprint. You've been talking specifically about the amount of water necessary to grow a particular crop, like the cucumbers or the barley. But when you really come down to it, the water footprint includes a lot of other aspects of getting that product to the consumer, to processing, even parts of transportation. So when you really look at it, are those numbers really telling us what the water footprint is for that particular product?
Yeah. So when we start looking at, and I kind of wish that I had talked to the folks at Roar Malting a little bit about that. When you look at some of these reports that have come from, like, the World Wildlife Fund and SAB Miller, what they've all kind of acknowledged is that the cultivation of crops is the lion's share. So when we look at, namely that's the spatial component of it. Brew house efficiency, there's certain laws of thermodynamics that dictate the efficiency of energy or water. And I typically, when I work with, farmers, I tell them to think about water as energy because it is, it's always going to, move to a lesser state. But when we start looking at water, we've pretty much maximized the efficiencies in our processing facilities to actually go through and process and wash bottles and do that. And those numbers are really small compared to, the large agricultural inputs that go into these products. If you guys spend a little bit of time on Google, you'll be able to find lots of different footprint calculators for, the water that goes into coffee, that goes into a loaf of bread, that goes into a lot of these other things. And, the largest component of that is still going to be, producing those things that grow and transpire and use water from the atmosphere. And those are governed by some laws that it's challenging to manage to increase that water use efficiency standpoint. Yeah. And, also, if you go and visit an ethanol facility, one of the first things that they'll crow about is how much water do they need to use to produce a gallon of ethanol. There's a question.
The question is maybe not entirely related to Minnesota, but I read these reports of how many gallons it takes to, to grow a pistachio nut in California. Does that include losses because it's stored in a lake and then goes through canals and then is put on the plant? Or is it just what the plant uses?
It is just what the plant is using. And that's one of the other, I really liked, you had one slide where you showed declining groundwater levels. And one of the areas that popped out was in the lower Mississippi Delta. I was in this spring or last fall, I was down in Phoenix, and one of my counterparts at Mississippi State was there, and his comment to me was, yeah, they're continuing to irrigate in the Mississippi Delta out of groundwater, but instead of, they've kind of gone through this generational shift where a lot of these guys, their center pivots are 30 years old, and they're going in to replace them, and instead of going to low-pressure center pivots, they're actually going back, and because they're, it's pretty flat down there, they've laser-leveled everything, they're going back to flood irrigation, which from a water use efficiency standpoint is incredibly low. We think of the delivery efficiency for flood irrigated fields being 60%, whereas opposed to a low pressure center pivot system might be 85% efficient. And for a subsurface drip irrigation system, we might assume 90% delivery efficiency, 95% delivery efficiencies.
I think we all recognize that water quantity is also dependent on water quality. And irrigation on these highly granular outwash plains that have high porosities infiltration rates are extremely high. And once that water gets beyond the root zone, it's gone to usage by that plant. And the application of fertilizers such as nitrate, once it hits that root zone and is gone, we're now putting it into the groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing significant amounts of nitrates in those types of soils. And yet, when we look at the rate of uptake, we're still only looking at 40 to 50% uptake of the nitrates.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see as the potential to reverse that trend?
Well, so what we're looking at here is, you know, anytime we see this line go back to zero, we filled the profile. And it doesn't really show this, but, you know, there was probably a leaching event right here. Anytime you see this spike back up to zero, there was probably a leaching event, especially for this early season when our root exploration might only be 6 inches in depth. It's going to be harder to have leaching events out here because of that big suck. We're using a lot of water. We have very deep root exploration. We're going to be assimilating, you know, water and nitrogen at much higher rates during that time period. One of the really great and one of the really terrifying components of nitrate-nitrogen pollution in groundwater is that nitrate is assimilated via a physiological process that we call mass flow, meaning plants aren't going to take up nitrogen if there's not water available to do that. There's a couple other uptake mechanisms, but usually about 80% of the nitrogen that plants will assimilate will be taken up via mass flow. From an agronomic management perspective, we've got to get away from doing stupid stuff. And, you know, sometimes, you know, in agriculture, we tend to cling to things, well, my grandfather did it this way, okay? If you go to central Nebraska, when you hear somebody say that, my natural response is, well, your grandfather polluted, you know, an aquifer that's, you know, 300 miles long. We did a lot of dumb stuff 50 years ago. And in some places, we continue to do dumb things. Preseason applications of nitrate and nitrogen are one of the best ways that I know of in a coarse textured soil to degrade groundwater. That's not universally true. Other, you know, where there are some places within the state that have coarse soils, you know, at the surface that don't have groundwater problems. But when you go to places like, you know, Becker, or you go to places like the Straight River, those are areas that have nitrate, nitrogen, groundwater contamination. When you look at some of the work that the Department of Ag has done in their nitrogen fertilizer management plan, what you're going to see is that they've come in and they've said, okay, you know, if you have a groundwater problem and you're doing dumb stuff, you could be regulated. If you stop doing dumb stuff, you're probably not going to be regulated. But we want everyone to stop doing dumb things. And that flies in the face, and that's kind of controversial a lot in the ag community. But in-season application of nitrogen in conjunction with, you know, high water use efficiency leads to high nitrogen use efficiency and can reduce our risk for nitrate nitrogen loss and the contamination of groundwater. That doesn't mean that we'll ever get away from contaminated aquifers. You know, when I reference certain laws of thermodynamics and your efficiencies are always going to be limited. You know, there's no perpetual motion machines. There's always going to be some nitrogen loss in an agronomic system. The question that we run into is, how do we balance that with the need to produce things that we all enjoy and or is essential to daily lives? And so I think as we go forward in the next 20 years, we're really going to be striking that balance between those two things.
I want to say, I think we have time for one question because you've been sitting a long time and I want to give you a break. So I'll take one more question, but then catch Josh during the break for follow-up. And I see we have a question over here.
Yeah, hi. So the water footprints can start to look like a lot of water for crops. I wonder if you could put this in the context, though, of if there weren't crops there, there would still be probably something growing there, or even from bare ground, there's some ET. So just in the context of either a natural system or bare ground, how do these compare?
Yeah, so if we consider, you know, a tall grass crop, you know, that's going to be pushing, you know, 20, let me get my calculator out. Oh, there it is. So let's assume that we're going to be talking about the ET of a grass crop or an alfalfa crop. So then we're going to be talking about 22 to 24 inches of seasonal ET between freeze times. So we'll take 23 inches of ET times 27,154. You're going to be talking about 624,000 gallons of water for that acre of grass or natural system. Now, if you go to somewhere like Cass County, where you have a lot of coarse textured outwash soil and you have, you know, what had been in timber, those ET rates are probably going to be similar just from a vegetative growth. The big difference is when you get into some of those systems, you have these long-lived perennial crops that may explore 10, 12 feet down, and they can go after, they can get into that top of the surficial aquifer. And so when you look at places like that, like the land conversions in Cass County, those are situations where you couldn't grow annual crops there without irrigation, but natural systems, perennial, extremely deep-rooted crops could survive there, but they're also going to use really high rates of water that's out of, you know, surficial aquifers. Thank you.
Thank you.